And after 7 years, he comes to our Lord, sort of like Job, and he says, so God says, how did you do with Hungary? He says, I can't figure out that language. So apparently, it's not, I've been told by Hungarians who they say, you know, people who are Hungarian Americans who try later in life to learn language just can't. It's almost impossible. So to learn Hungarian is a big task.
It is. Fortunately, he was tutored in it from childhood. His wife would learn it a little later, but she became very, very fluent in Magyar as well. She was great with languages too. The Habsburgs.
Otto spoke it too, right? Otto, his son.
He sure did. Yeah, Otto spoke it. His mother Zita, the Empress, the wife of Karl, she oversaw the education of the eight children, and particularly that of Otto, whom she ensured spoke all of the languages. One of the ways they would do this is by speaking a different language every day. So, like, I forget the exact details. Like, one day it was German, one day it was French, one day it was Magyar, one day it was Czech, and so on, to make sure that the children were completely capable in all these languages.
Amazing. So how is it that he rose to the imperial throne, given the relative unlikeliness of this?
Well, several things happened. Firstly, his cousin, second cousin, Franz Josef's son, second cousin once removed, Crown Prince Rudolf, either committed suicide or was murdered at Meierling. A case which remains the Kennedy assassination of the 19th century.
Okay, so it's
very, still, very mysterious.
It's still a mystery. Presumably, people argue over it still.
They sure do. And one of the things I learned in my inquiries, I mean, the Empress Zita, of course, maintained that he'd been murdered. It was given out that he'd committed suicide in a fit of insanity. I learned while I was here, because, you know, our landlords in this part of the world are the great Cistercian Abbey of Heiligenkreuz.
Holy Cross.
That's the one. It's got a really big chunk, one of the two biggest chunks of the cross in existence, the other one being in Poitiers, in France. But the monks of Heiligenkreuz were the people who received the body initially. And the story is told to this day amongst the monks that Rudolf's fingers were all broken.
Oof.
And the theory, by those who hold this, the theory is that he was holding the bedroom door shut with a table against a person or persons unknown.
Intruding.
Unknown assailants.
I see.
What's that?
Intruders.
Intruders. And they were able to push the door open eventually, breaking his fingers, having done so. Whether or not that's true, whether or not that was the scenario that occurred, it's highly unlikely that he could have killed himself with a pistol with broken fingers.
Yeah.
It's just not really. The only way we would know for sure is if they opened up his box in the Kaisergruft and looked at the fingers, but that's extremely unlikely. I don't think the family would ever consent to it.
I see.
So, in all likelihood, it will remain the Kennedy assassination of the 19th century.
So there's his death, and then what else happens that occasions the rise of Karl to the throne?
Well, Franz Ferdinand becomes heir with Rudolf's death. But Franz Ferdinand, as I mentioned, marries morganatically, so his children can't inherit, which means Otto predeceasing Franz Ferdinand, the heirship devolves upon Karl. So in 1914, when Franz Ferdinand is murdered, Karl is Franz Ferdinand's heir, Franz Ferdinand is Franz Josef's heir. Franz Josef being the great-uncle of Karl, uncle of Franz Ferdinand. Now, the thing to bear in mind, too, was that there was a rift of sorts between Franz Ferdinand and Franz Josef, partly personal over the morganatic marriage, partly political, because Franz Ferdinand wanted to restructure the empire along federal lines. And Franz Josef, having worked very, very hard over the course of a long life to achieve the constitutional settlement that they had, didn't want to change anything. So this led to a certain amount of difficulty between them. Also, Franz Ferdinand had very different ideas about Austrian foreign policy. Now, and this too is where Karl's experience of dealing with his parents came in
He
very handy.
was less belligerent, right? I mean, he was.
He was less belligerent, and he was much. You mean Karl or Franz Ferdinand?
I mean, Franz Ferdinand.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was
More,
less
less
more.
belligerent than his than Franz Joseph.
Less and more at the same time. Less in the sense that he wanted. And again, this is suspicion on my part. There may be more proof outstanding, but it seems to me, from what I've examined, that he wanted closer ties with Russia and Britain. And he felt that they were too dependent on Germany. Now, I say that in that sense, he was less belligerent in a sense than Franz Josef, but only in a sense because Franz Josef didn't want war. But Franz Josef was very dependent on a lot of his military and civil advisors, most of whom Franz Ferdinand had very little use for.
I see, I see.
So he was more belligerent in the sense that he would have taken a much stronger hand in government.
I see.
I
So
mean,
if we can bubble up to the top, just sort of checking off the circumstances that led to Karl getting to the throne,
right. So Franz Ferdinand's brother Otto, Karl's father, dies, leaving Franz Joseph, Franz Ferdinand, and then Karl. Franz Ferdinand is murdered in 1914. That starts World War I, and so with that, Karl becomes Franz Joseph's immediate heir. And so when Franz Joseph died, Karl became emperor in 1916.
So
Now,
there were roughly, what, 2 years, 3 years intervening between the death of Franz Joseph and the Franz Ferdinand, pardon me, and Karl getting to the throne.
correct.
So
There are 2 years.
he must have had to, prepare himself quickly for the task at hand.
Well, he did, and unfortunately, those 2 years were packed with a lot of stuff for him. For one thing, his great uncle used him as a sort of roving eyewitness. So, in addition to at various times commanding troops on the front, he would also make whirlwind visits all over wherever the fighting was going on, Galicia, in the south of Serbia, on the Tyrolean front with Italy, and then when war began with Romania, he went down to Transylvania because he would constantly oversee what was going on and report everything to his great uncle, who wanted obviously to know how the war was going. Now, this had a benefit and it had a drawback. The benefit was that it made him very familiar with the war. He knew exactly what was going on. He knew, and he was, he was fearless. So he very often went up to the front lines, and his soldiers loved him as a result. On one occasion,
So he was, excuse me, he was an officer in the Austrian military then.
yeah, he was a general and field marshal.
Okay.
And he, but that those his high rank didn't keep him from going up to the front. And as I say, on one occasion, during a flash flood in the Tyrol, at great risk to himself, he jumped into a flash flood and rescued a somewhat lame soldier who'd been washed away in the water and who wouldn't have made it without, So this was
So he
a
wasn't just some sort of a fop. I mean, he actually, had experience in uniform, and it wasn't just for show.
Absolutely. He'd been very well trained before the war, both civilly and militarily. He was fearless, personally fearless, and yet extremely humane
Okay,
in
so
turn.
you say, okay, I'd like to talk about him under three headings, because I know he's a soldier, he's an emperor, he's he's the husband and father as well, which that would give us our three headings. You've touched upon soldier. So you say he was fearless. Aside from the Tyrolean, injured soldier that he rescued from the flash flood, are there any other instances that would indicate that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact that when he was in positions who were being shelled, he didn't run. He just stood there, and stood there with his men. which earned him, as I say, their tremendous affection. You've got to bear in mind that for a great deal of the time, the war on the Eastern Front was also static. It wasn't quite like the Western Front, which, with the horrible trench warfare. But in Tyrol, you had this, they called it the White Hell. The Austrians and Italians were stuck up in the Alps. One of the things they tried to do would be to shell snowbanks above the enemy's position in hopes of starting,
An avalanche.
which they did from time to time.
Oh,
So to this
goodness.
day, especially now that the snow's melting in various places, they continue to uncover headquarters and military shacks and whatnot, very often with everything intact inside.
Wow. Including people?
Sometimes.
Wow.
I mean, it's, but then on the Transylvanian front, it was a bit more fluid. In Galicia against the Russians, it went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But oddly enough, despite everyone's fears, and B, despite what a lot of the nationalists like to claim after the war, the very multinational Austro-Hungarian army held together very well. And in retrospect, Karl's efforts contributed quite a bit toward that.
Which would indicate that the idea of the Imperium wasn't exactly untenable.
No, not at all. And in fact, one of the interesting things today is that in those countries, Poland, Ukraine, Serbia, Romania, Montenegro, that have areas, Poland, areas that were Habsburg and areas that were not, to this day they have what they call the Habsburg effect, which means that the attitudes toward government, the levels of corruption, the attitudes toward government are much better, the levels of corruption are less, and the voting patterns very often run almost exactly along the old borders.
Interesting, interesting.
So, like in Poland, for instance, in the recent presidential elections, the president carried the old Russian and the old Austrian sectors completely. Where he lost out to a great degree was in the areas that had been German.
Okay, under Prussia, huh?
Exactly.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's, and that's interesting too, because Polish culture was about equally suppressed in Russia and Prussia, but it was very much encouraged by the Habsburgs.